welcome to our convention. How about a hand for our speaker tonight, Amy? Next time, be a little bit more, you know, personal with it. If you know, cousin, sister, wow. I want to hear Greg's version. I think he remembers more. So we're really grateful to be here tonight and grateful to do this interview with an alcoholic. People ask me, what is really that all about? What's the purpose? And it's kind of like Mark Twain, what he said about golf. He said golf was a good walk spoiled. You golfers will understand that. And this is a great pitch interrupted. So this guy I met early in sobriety, and I was very impressed. I'll tell you why in a minute, and hopefully you'll be impressed and enlightened. Please put your hands together and welcome Mississippi Mike.
Is this mic working?
I'll wait. Oh, beautiful. Here we are. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
All right, beautiful.
It came unplugged.
Oh, great. Can you hear me now? Okay, great. Man, let me get this. Yeah. Bring it out of my pocket. You'll be good. Okay.
Oh, you don't use the wireless?
No, we're good. All right, here we go. Okay. Once again, my name is Steve. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Steve.
So, Mike and I met long ago, 1989, and I was very impressed with him. It was the hair and the boots, the beard, the drawl. Back then, he wore a full-length duster coat. He was, you know, Clint Eastwood reimagined, and right out of a Marlboro commercial. And anytime I'm at an AA meeting and I get to participate, I always want to start out with something about recovery, because when we get into our qualifications, sometimes we kind of wander and wind up meandering a little bit. So the first thing I want to ask Mike is, what is an AA? One of the first things I heard you say that struck me was, I recall you saying that there's no big deals. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, my name is Mike Lefebvre, and I'm an alcoholic. Grateful for God today for my sobriety. When I first got sober, I was told that there are no big deals, that no matter what happens, there's no big deals, and don't sweat the small stuff. And I found that served me well throughout the years of living by no big deals.
Who is it that first told you about that, and what brought it up?
That was my first sponsor, Arizona Paul, Paul J. from Arizona. He, I was in a detox unit in Phoenix, and I did a Thorazine shuffle for about 10 days. And I had a girlfriend, and when I went into the treatment center, I told her, I said, look, I don't know what's going to happen. I said, I got serious problems. I said, but you ought to go ahead and live your life, do what you're going to do, and you know, whatever happens will happen. And she said, okay. So I found out after being in there for like 10 days, I'm going into a bed opened up, and I'm going in, and I said, I'm going to call her and tell her I'm going in. And he said, no, don't call her. There's no need in calling her. Just do what you got to do and leave it. And I said, but I need to call. I said, look, Mike, if there's anything there, she's going to be there in 30 days when you get out. If she's not, you didn't have anything anyway. So I said, okay. He says, you just leave it alone. So I called her. And she already had a date. I was still in the detox unit, and she had a date. And she said, well, you told me to. I said, well, I didn't mean it. So anyway, and that's when Paul told me, he said, look, that's one of many. That's becoming of. He said, there's no big deals, man. So what? So what? Now what? Don't sweat the small stuff.
She wasn't dating your sponsor, was she?
No.
Oh, okay, good. Just checking. That has happened. So where are you from, Mississippi, Mike?
Well, I was born in New Orleans, and I was raised in Gulfport, Mississippi. And I went to work in the oil field when I was 18, working on drilling rigs in the Gulf of Mexico and South America. And I moved out west after the oil field died in 84. The price of oil dropped, and the drilling slowed down. So I left the oil field and moved out west, and moved out to the San Fernando Valley. And I got sober in Phoenix, and I said I need to get out of Phoenix because all my friends were drinkers, and I knew if I stayed, I would drink again. I had to change everything in my life, and I left at 2 o'clock in the morning without saying a word to my buddy. I just left. And when I got to LA the next day, I called him and told him, I said, look, Randy, I had to leave. He's the guy that got me into detox. And he said, I had to leave. I said, cause I said, I would drink with you. And he was my boss. He was my mentor. And I looked up to him and I knew that my life depended on it. So I left. And he said, I understand. And, we stayed friends. But I forgot what I was telling you about.
You're talking about memory loss and drinking? No, so, you got sober in Phoenix.
Yeah.
So and right after you got a year, you moved here to L.A. and met your buddy.
Yeah, so I moved to Phoenix. I had a sister living in L.A., so I'd never been to L.A., so I said, what the hell? So I packed up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I drove to L.A., and I got here and went to some meetings, and I was in a meeting. I met this couple from Alabama, and I said, where do y'all go to meetings? They said, it's a great meeting you got to go to at the Valley Club. She goes, we're there every morning at 7 o'clock. So I said, all right. So I went the next morning at 7 o'clock, and they weren't there.
So I was, liars.
So I was so pissed off, and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, well, what am I going to do? I'm here. And I looked over and I saw this guy sitting with cowboy boots on. So I said, well, I guess I could, I didn't know what to say. So I said, hey man, I like your boots. He said, thanks. I like yours. And one thing led to another, and it was Steve. And, we decided to go get coffee after the meeting, and we went and got coffee and found out we had both read the part in the book where it says, we're not a glum lot. We both got together and said, look, we didn't get sober to be miserable. And I said, I sure didn't. And he said, pal, I'm with you. So I said, look, I've never been to Tijuana. You think we could go to Tijuana? So he said, why not? So we jumped in his car and we headed to Tijuana. And when we got to Tijuana, we said, you know, nobody's going to believe that we went to Tijuana. He said, I got to get proof from my wife. So we took a picture on that donkey, you know, with the sombrero and the...
They were like, very large sombreros, by the way.
We got a picture with a donkey in Tijuana and came back, and we've been running ever since. I suggest if you're new, find somebody that's got about the same amount of sobriety as you do and let them be your running buddy. I always knew what meeting we were going to go to. If Steve called me or I called him, we always knew we had a morning meeting, a noon meeting, and an evening meeting. And that's what we did for the first couple, 3 years, every day, doing 12-step work, going to meetings, going to conventions, going to the roundups, going to the concerts. We were just doing it all.
That's right. You know, one of the things that we both latched onto early on, there was a guy named Al Marin who was at the Valley Club pretty often, and he was 39 years sober at the time, which seemed impossible. But, you know, when somebody would start their show, they say, oh, I'm a grateful alcoholic. And they might have a little bit of a frown. And Al would say, tell your face. And we were just shocked that a guy would be that direct. But the thing that we were always talking about is you know, Al just doesn't give a shit what anybody thinks about him. He says what's on his mind. And I asked him to be my sponsor because I thought, how do you get there? How do you get to be who you are and not worry about it? And, you know, we both have exhibited some behaviors that we weren't proud of when we were trying to change. And just sobering up is not enough. It's a great start. And Amy talked about that. And I want to get into, I'm really grateful, which always chokes me up. I'm really grateful you talked about therapy and especially where you are in your journey, because there's a few of us around here that could utilize that. I've also discovered in my 32 years that a lot of us have other issues that require some outside help. And my mother was the beneficiary of the loving embrace of the group of alcoholics in Binghamton, New York. And she put together about 6 years of sobriety. And the only way she was able to do that at that point after relapsing for 25 years was she found a shrink. This is back in the early 80s, who identified that she had a disease called bipolar disorder. And he put her on meds, and they worked. And the well-meaning folks in Alcoholics Anonymous back there told her that she couldn't claim sobriety if she was on medication. And she lost her life. She took her own life because she couldn't stay on her meds. She couldn't stay sober off her meds. And they were well-meaning, but they were giving her advice they shouldn't have offered her. And Mike had some of that in his history, and I want to talk a little bit about that. If you want to tell us how you wound up at Olive View, one of the swankier locations here in Los Angeles.
Well, I ended up in Olive View. And
sixth floor lockdown.
Yeah, whenever you get off the elevator and there's no down button, you know that you're in lockdown. I got out of Olive View, and Steve said, "Mike, you think you're going to stay on your meds this time?" And I said, "Well, because when you take them, you feel better. You don't need them." And right? Well, anyway, he said, "You think you're going to take your meds this time?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so." I said, "Well," he said, "Yeah, my wife just picked you up from Olive View. I think you ought to take your meds." So I've been in another house 5 times in 4 different states in sobriety. And when I'm on my medication, it's just perfect. And sometimes it gets a little hairy, but I need an adjustment. And I go get it adjusted, and everything works out fine. But the doctor said, "Mike, you've done the first thing in getting sober. You got to have sobriety to get a baseline on you. I can't treat your bipolar disorder if you're drinking and using." So he said, "You're already sober, so that's the biggest step in doing this." And I'm glad you didn't go out, you know, in your craziness. When you were, because I had a real frank doctor. We didn't mince words or play around. I said, "Doc, I'm in the Ha Ha Hotel. I'm aware that something's wrong. I'm not sure what it is, but every now and then I slip into neutral. And I just can't get going." And he said, "You know, that's treatable with medication today. You're lucky. You have Alcoholics Anonymous and you have medication." And he said, "They didn't have that 30, 40, 50 years ago." So he said, "People like you ended up in institutions like this for life." And he said, "You don't have to." And fortunately, I haven't been back in several years. So things are going good.
Well, what is your sobriety date, Mike?
My original sobriety date is 9/8/88. And I tell that because my sobriety date is December 26, 1998. And I tell people that I have 2 sobriety dates because at 10 years of sobriety, I drank again. And it's not new. It's not a mystery. I quit calling my buddies. I quit going to meetings. I started a new job. I started making pretty good money. I started, you know, all that started. My life got too busy for AA, and I was hanging out in a sports bar. It was a bar room, but they served food, so I called it a sports bar. And that was okay for me to be there, because I'm the designated driver. And all of my friends drank. Every friend I had but one drank. And so I was hanging around drinkers. But I was maintaining. I was doing okay. I had 10 years sobriety. I don't want to drink. Until a guy I didn't even know was standing next to me, and he said, "Hey, buddy, you want a beer?" And my right hand to God, I didn't even think about it. I said, "Absolutely." And he handed me a beer, and I took a draw off of it. And as I'm sucking it down, I'm looking up, and I see this bartender, and she's wiping the bar down, and she froze. And she was looking at me like a deer in headlights, like, "What are you doing?" And the shame and guilt just swallowed me up, because I knew right then I was wrong, and I shouldn't be doing this. So from the very get-go, my drinking was no fun. It took me 6 days. I figured I'd have a six-month run, but I knew I'd have to come back. And in 6 days, I went from pretty popular, pretty well-liked, to not anybody in the city of Lafayette, Louisiana, speaking to me. I had gone to Christmas parties at all my buddies' houses, and all their wives said I was not allowed back, and they couldn't hang out with me anymore. You know, I pulled my pants down. I told dirty jokes. I did all the things that you know, that says in the book, you know, we do inappropriate things at the wrong time, and man, did I knock it out of the park. Not one person, and this is the truth, not one person to this day has ever reached out and said, "How you doing?" At the end of my six-day run, I had got my rifle out, and I was going to shoot myself. I said, I just can't keep doing this, and I don't think I can get sober again, and I'm not going to live drunk. So I wasn't sad, but I put the gun under my chin, and I put it down, and I watched TV. And, of course, I was drinking, and I put the gun under my chin, and I put it down, and I was drinking. And I put the gun down one time, and I stood up. And I was holding the rifle like this, and the sight got caught on my jeans. And I had a coffee table between me and the couch, and it was caught on my jeans. And I said, "Damn it." I said, "Son of a bitch." And I yanked it up, and when I did, it went bam. It went off and shot me in the leg. Well, it was an AK-47. I don't recommend it, but I did get sober.
We were shocked he didn't die when he shot himself in the ankle.
So, I don't recommend it, but I did sober up, and I was laid up in a sugarcane field in Lafayette, Louisiana, in a single wide trailer. See, I got to tell the truth because people verify my story. I'd love to say I was in a double wide somewhere, but it was a single wide trailer in this little field in Lafayette, Louisiana, and I was laid up in there, and I got a phone call one day, and it was Steve, and I said, "Hey, man, what's going on?" He said, "Hey, I didn't call you to shoot the shit." And I said, "What's up?" I thought something was wrong, and he said, "You're going to die if you stay in that trailer." He said, "You got to do one or two things. Do you trust me?" And I said, "Well, yeah." He said, "Then you got to do one or two things." I said, "What's that?" He said, "You either got to go to the airport and there'll be a ticket waiting for you at the counter, or get in your car and head this way, but you got to come back to the L.A. and get sober again. Get back out here where people care about you." And I knew right then that I had to listen to what he said. So I said, I'll drive the next morning. And the next morning I got up, and what wouldn't fit in my car, I left. And I liked that, like that was a lot, but all my furniture was rented. So there wasn't nothing but wouldn't fit in my car. So I loaded everything up, fit in my car, and I headed that way. And I came back out to L.A., and I got back in, and I started my new sobriety date. And so Steve said, "Well, what's your date?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." He said, "You got to have a date." And I said, "All right, then that's going to be December 25th, 1998. He said, "No, we're not doing that to Jesus. You got to pick another day." So I said, "All right, the 26th. And he said, "Okay, the 26th is good." So my sobriety date is December 26th, 1998. And I haven't looked back since.
Right on. So, Jim, I don't know if you have those slides up, or those slides are handy to put on the screen. Jim Chrisman? Slides, do you have those up ready to go by any chance that I emailed you? No big deal if you didn't. Anyway, the reason I want to bring up the slides is one of the reasons I asked Mike to do this interview was we've both been... the beneficiaries of great sponsorship, and Mike had one of the best, a gentleman named Mike Finnegan. And, God damn it. We just lost him in August. And because of, you know, the way things are, we didn't really get to pay tribute to Mike the way we wanted to. So tell me about your experience with the amazingly talented singer and B3 player and awesome AA dude, Mike Finnegan.
Well, Mike's one of the ones that there's a few people in AA I think saved my life, and Mike was one of them, because when I got here, he said, I'm kind of used to pushing and shoving and doing what I want to do, and when I got here, Mike is 6'5 and 220 pounds and is allergic to bullshit, and he finally told me after a few meetings, he finally said, hey, wait, ho. He said, I don't care how you feel, punk. I care how you act. He said, you got to start acting right. He said, you're out of line. He said, you need to line up your acting with your thinking. He said, but you don't think yourself into good graces. You act yourself into good graces. And by doing action is what gets you sober. So Mike taught me just everything that I know about Alcoholics Anonymous I got from Mike. He taught me one of the best lessons I ever learned was, he told me, he said, look, I want you to go out. And he would tell me this stuff like it's his idea. I didn't know later it was all in the book. You know, I thought he was coming up with all these great things. And he said, look, I want you to go out and I want you to go do something good for somebody today. I want you to go out of your way. Not just somebody, if you're going one way and somebody says, can I have a ride? Give them a ride, because that's not doing anything really out of your way. If somebody says, I need a ride, and it's 20 miles the other direction, that's a favor. So I want you to go out and do something good for somebody today, and then don't tell anybody. And I said, for what's that for? I said, what good is that? He said, just go out and do something good for somebody and don't tell anybody. So I did, and I couldn't wait to get back and tell him. And he said, that's great. He said, that's the right idea. And he said, but now you got to go do it again. I said, no, I'm done, man. I did it today. He said, I know. It doesn't count, dumbass. You told me. So I subscribed to go out and do something good for somebody and then don't tell anybody you did it. I promise you, if you're feeling bad or you're not feeling right or you're down on yourself or whatever the reason, you got self-doubt, if you go do those things, I guarantee you will feel better. It's not possible not to. If you go do something good for somebody and keep it to yourself and do it just for doing it between you and God, that you did it. My God's always looking down at me going, put it back. Don't you touch it. So I also see my God smiling, saying, atta boy, way to go. So that's what I got from Mike.
Cool. One of the things that Mike likes to say that his offending nerve has been removed. And when he moved back to Mississippi, he didn't find the fellowship that he was used to that he experienced here in Los Angeles, which I've been all over the world as a musician. I can tell you, this is the shit. The recovery in Los Angeles is unlike anywhere else. Nothing away from Alabama, but it's awesome here. And he was not finding that there. And right about then, I had an operation. And the day I had an operation was the day everything shut down, March 16th of 2020. And I said, I'm going to start a meeting. And I said, they got this thing called Zoom. And I want you to come to our meeting. It was me and Nathan Hirschfeld and Michael Dorian, a bunch of, you know, Valley sober dudes. We started this 9 a.m. stag meeting, and Mike didn't show up for the first few days. And I called him up, and I go, hey, man, you haven't been on the meeting. He goes, I don't know all this Zoom thing. I'm old school. I said, are you retired? And he goes, yep. I said, what are you doing today? He goes, nothing. I said, well, get off your ass and get on your computer and figure out how to Zoom. Like your life depended on it, newcomer. I call him that sometimes. It really pisses him off.
It hurts.
So tell us how you discovered your offending nerve and how you got rid of it.
Well, I don't know. I would hear people say I was offended and I got offended, and I'm pretty sick of political correctness. And I know that's a sentiment that's shared widely in this room. But I got to where I started thinking, when I started to get my ruffles flared up, I think, you know, that offends me. And I started laughing, thinking, who am I to be offended? What a punk. I'm offended. First off, you could give a shit that I'm offended. You know, and it was hilarious to me that I'm offended. So I made my decision right then and there, and it's a conscious decision, like being grateful. My decision to not be offended is that you just can't offend me. I don't give you that power. Whenever something goes wrong and I don't like it, I just, so what, now what? Ain't no big deal. But I'm not offended by nothing you say or do. You can't get me.
So one of the things that used to come up, because Mike was a barroom fighter, when we would talk about getting frustrated over something live, we'd say, yeah, I was getting ready to tune that guy up. And Mike brought that up to it. Oh, I want to give credit to David Rubens also for helping start that meeting. He'll be very offended I didn't mention him. He's sensitive. Thank you, David, for starting that meeting, by the way. One of the things that you got a lot from one of the guys from the Roxbury Men's Group, a guy named Bob Cleveland. God bless him. Tell us about his ideas about tuning somebody up.
There was this guy that had called me out. Long story short is he literally called me out in front of all my friends. And, because of AA, I didn't hit him right away. I held back, and I got to thinking about it, and I said, no, I'm not going to do anything. And I said, no, I'm going to light his ass up. So I thought about it, and I said, you know, he's got a sponsor that I really respect, Bob Cleveland. And I said, so I'm going to call Bob and tell him why I'm doing it, what I'm going to do, and so you won't get it secondhand, you'll hear it from me. So I told Bob the story, and he said, Mike, look, if he had done that to me, I might feel just like you do. But let me tell you what I've learned in my 15 years of sponsoring guys. He said, I've never met a guy that hit another human being and stayed sober. And he said, let somebody else pick up the tab. Because if he's doing that to you, he's going to do that to somebody else that doesn't have a spiritual program. And they're going to tune him up. And so he said, let somebody else carry the weight. Don't you pick it up. And I can tell you that since September 8, 1988, I haven't hit another person. And for me, that's a big deal because, see, I didn't do it because I was a tough guy. I did it because I was scared to death. I was just full of fear. So I hit you before you could hit me. I wasn't one of these guys you see saying, screw you. No, screw you. No, screw you. No, screw you. And that was it. But it wasn't because, like I said, because I was a tough guy. It's because I was just horribly afraid. And I didn't want you to know it or anybody else to know it. And until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and I found out it was okay that men get scared. But they do it anyway. You know, there's a saying we have in our group, just do it scared. And I found that serves me well as well.
I don't. So there's one other idea that Mike discovered, or a poem that he discovered when he was at a very low point. He likes to say he was at the end of his rope, and he saw a poem. Can you tell us about that?
Footprints. There's a poem called Footprints, and most of you have probably seen it, but those that haven't, it's about a guy that is walking down the beach with his Lord, and there's two sets of footprints in the sand. And the guy is looking at his life flash before his eyes, and he sees that when he's at his weakest point, when he's at his lowest point in his life, there's only one set of footprints. And so he asked God, he said, God, he said, when I was at the bottom of my life, when things were the worst, he said, why is there only one set of footprints? Why would you abandon me? And God said, my precious child, I would never abandon you. When you only saw one set of footprints, it was then I was carrying you. And I was in a men's treatment center. When I got out of that detox, I went to a 30-day treatment center. And I was in the bathroom, using the bathroom, and I'm looking at the wall, and that's where Footprints was. And the guy kept telling me, in the state of mind you're in right now, you can take one drink and then put it away and not drink anymore. But once you had that first drink, you're no longer in the same state of mind. Okay, I didn't get it. I didn't get it at all. And I kept saying, tell me again. Well, at about 25 days, I got him by the collar and I said, tell me, explain it to me. Why do I get drunk and get thrown out of the place? Why do I get drunk and in relationships? Why do I get so drunk? Because I said, when I have that one drink, he said, Mike, you're no longer in the same state of mind. I don't know another way to say it. And when I read that Footprints, it just came like somebody threw warm water on me. I got it. It came crystal clear. When I have that line of dope or that shot of dope and that shot of whiskey, I'm no longer in the same state of mind I am right now to turn down the next drink. And it's not the first one that gets me. I mean, it's not the second one that gets me. It's the first one. And I that became crystal clear when I read Footprints. It just made a big impression in my life.
Thanks. Can you tell us about your relationship with the girls that call you Uncle Mike?
No. Oh. Steve's got two daughters, and I helped raise them. And and I helped raise them. And I didn't want nothing to do with kids. I don't like kids. They're grimy. And I didn't want anything to do with kids until Sammy was born. And I got a picture of her in my cowboy hat. That's how small she was. She fit in my hat. And so I raised these girls, Sammy and her sister Emily, and I helped raise them and became very close to them. It's the closest thing I have to a daughter or to daughters. And Steve and I have a thing that we go by is that we've decided that we're not going to do or say anything out in life that we can't do or say in front of his daughters. So that kind of keeps a governor on me from flying off the handle or saying or doing something that's inappropriate that I wouldn't be proud for them to hear me say or do. So that's how I got the Uncle Mike moniker.
And there's my daughter Sammy right there. Say hi, Sammy. So one other theme I want to touch on real quick here before we end. And then we have a great comedian coming up. In our recent journey in this day age of Zoom, we have this morning meeting that I mentioned. It's about 60 guys a day. And one of the members of that group started another meeting, which is called the secular meeting. There's a lot of movement, especially younger folks in AA, where they're moving away from the God component. They're utilizing the 12 steps, but they've figured out that the God component doesn't work for them. And that sounds like it's very anti-AA. And Mike is a Christian. He's very active in his church. He, you know, does a lot of service at his church in Mississippi. He doesn't make our Sunday morning meeting because of it, which is kind of a drag for us, but that's what he does. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about that realization he goes to the secular meeting, but he still has a relationship with God. Tell us why you go to that meeting.
Well, I go to the meeting because I was told by one of my preachers that don't write off the atheists, that you'll learn a lot from them, and that they in their life had learned a lot from the atheists. And the guy that started it, Nathan, is he cringes when I say this, but he's the bullshit detector.
Is that the lie detector? I believe that's probably a fire alarm. Rick, is this protocol? Are we supposed to evacuate this room now? Look at this calm room full of alcoholics. Or you're in denial. I don't know which it is.
Let her burn.
That's not the closing we had in mind.
I guess maybe we shouldn't have mentioned atheist. Way to go, Mike. Well, we can say that you got a walking ovation tonight. Thank you, Mike.